chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make to have in the middle of it. Rest make to have in the middle. We are rest make to have.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler. We are starting off the program with Dr. Michael Yeardon, interviewed by Alex. And he's a former Pfizer executive, and he's very, very well, you know, known now as a conspiracy, a vaccine conspiracy person. So they've tried to discourage him and discredit him, but he's a fine person, and here's what he has to say. There's some pronouncements at the beginning, and then we'll bring up Alex's interview with him. It's about an 11-minute clip. I'm going to pull up the full interview with Dr. Yeardon, and you'll be able to listen to the whole thing if you come in to thesecrettruth.com. But here we go with Dr. Yeardon.
If I just make three quick points. The first is we've been lied to by government officials and corporate types about absolutely everything to do with this so-called virus pandemic, the severity of the public health threats, the necessity to lock down asymptomatic transmission, the use of masks, mass testing, and finally, vaccines. Every single part of the narrative, every single part is a lie, scientifically proven. And I know that the people like Fauci, like Sir Patrick Vallance, were lying through the TVs to the audience because we share a common training. I trained at the same kind of universities at the same time. That meant we had the same foundational training, for example, in immunology. And then when they said things I knew were not true, I knew that they knew that too, and that they were lying to you. And that was what kickstarted me from very early on. So basically, they're not frightened of people like me because they figure that I won't be heard. So here's the thing. Please, listener, what I ask you to do is memorize two or three of the most powerful things I told you. You must go and tell 10 other people. Please don't tell me it's hard. I know it's hard. I've been trying to do this for almost 3 years. But the only way we'll win is if you tell 10 other people. The mass media is never going to tell them, right? They're never going to tell them. And they won't work it out on their own. They're still in the narrative. What I think is going to happen, and I wish I wasn't being right, I think they will make digital ID mandatory. Not necessarily vaccine passport, but that would do. Digital ID will become mandatory, and you will not be able to shop or travel or work without it or get healthcare. And I think the other thing they'll do is withdraw cash and replace all currency with central bank digital currencies. At that point, Alex, if they say if you don't get your next jab, we'll not allow you to buy gasoline or travel or buy food, that the system I've just described is trivial. It's already ready to go.
A poll went up on Infowars.com this morning. It's got 15,700 votes as of a few minutes ago when I printed this off. And we asked, what issue is most concerning to you right now? Illegal immigration, economy, censorship, medical tyranny. Illegal immigration was 26%, economy 25%, censorship 11%, medical tyranny 37%. And whoever the crew put that up, it's a good poll, but I would have just added the other point of the war in Ukraine leading to nuclear war, with the doomsday clock moved by the International Committee to 90 seconds to total Armageddon. But I would ask our next guest, what does he think is a bigger issue, the medical tyranny or the world marching towards thermonuclear war? And I think both of them are the same subject of an establishment that's gone quite mad. Well, we've had a lot of big guests on here, but of the top two or three people that from the beginning have exposed this, the guy that first, well over 2 years ago, that specifically predicted everything that was going to happen, filed emergency motions. The European Union Parliament that I saw with Wolfgang Wodarg and others was Dr. Michael Yeadon, and he couldn't have a better curriculum vitae or a background. Dr. Yeadon is a professional research scientist. He's a lifelong career in big pharma and biotech R&D, preceded by training with joint first-class honors in biochemistry and toxicology. He also did 3 years of research based on impact of opiates on receptors. Even more noteworthy is that he used the fentanyl class of synthetic opiates invented at Janssen Labs, now part of Johnson & Johnson, which places him in a unique position to offer expert testimony as well. He has trained and practiced research across a wide range of relevant life sciences for 40 years. He retired, 4 years ago or so, or he can correct me, from Pfizer as their vice president, one of their main directors. But I'm going to let him give you his background so I don't get it wrong. But you couldn't have a more credentialed individual, and I'd call him really, really establishment whistleblower, than Dr. Michael Yeadon. I'm going to do my best because we have millions of people tuned in to try to let him just lead this discussion where he wants to go here in the next 50 minutes we have. So, Dr. Yeadon, take it over.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a real privilege to speak to you and through you, hopefully to a large audience, some of whom have not heard from me before. So, yes, I think it would be fair to say I am the most qualified former pharmaceutical company executive speaking anywhere in the world. That was true early in 2020, and it's still true now, sadly. As you say, I have a proper training in biochemistry, toxicology, and then a research-based PhD on opiates and respiration. Then I spent 23 years in Big Pharma, leaving Pfizer as their vice president and worldwide head of respiratory research in 2011. And then I worked for 10 years in biotech. I founded a biotech company myself. I was the CEO, and I led that through financing, clinical trials, and it was acquired by Novartis in 2017. So the point of saying this is I think I am the peer scientifically of anyone you will hear on the TV in public health, like Dr. Fauci or Sir Patrick Vallance in the UK, or any of the senior pharmaceutical R&D staff that are running the vaccine R&D programs right now. I know personally 3 of the 4 people running it. And I realized very early on, March 2020, that basically we were under attack, and I knew this for this reason. We had imposed upon us lockdowns, an absurd prison slang type of approach for which there was no precedent anywhere in public health.
Sorry, sir, your Skype broke up for 5 seconds. Please continue.
Okay. So basically the lockdown told us that there was a supranational plot, I'm afraid, to impose these measures upon us. And then if I just make 3 quick points. The first is we've been lied to by government officials and corporate types about absolutely everything to do with this so-called virus pandemic, the severity of the public health threat, the necessity to lock down asymptomatic transmission, the use of masks, mass testing, and finally vaccines. Every single part of the narrative, every single part is a lie, scientifically proven. And I know that the people like Fauci, like Sir Patrick Vallance, were lying through the TVs to the audience because we share a common training. I trained at the same kind of universities at the same time. That meant we had the same foundational training, for example, in immunology. And then when they said things I knew were not true, I knew that they knew that too, and that they were lying to you. And that was what kick-started me from very early on.
Well, I'm not a famous, well-known scientist, top of your class like you, but I know basic things like learned immunity is better than artificial immunity. And they said, no, that's not the case. Or they said this was a vaccine when it wasn't a classic vaccine. I mean, they were attacking therapeutics that the Pentagon had tested years ago and said were really good for these type of viruses. So I was having the same concerns as a layperson, and then I saw your research, and it really validated my basic understanding.
No, you're right. And in fact, I've got a couple of phrases people told me were very powerful. Just threw them out there. So I've got this rhetorical question, Alex. What's the right number of times your public health officials should lie to you in a way that could cost you your health or your life? What's the right number? Now, I think the answer is 0, right? It shouldn't deliberately tell you things that they know to be untrue. Well, you just listed three or four. I found six, seven, eight. There is no question. These people are lying to you. When people lie to you, it's to hide something or to introduce something. And I think they are introducing these so-called vaccines. And to cut to the chase, there was no necessity whatsoever to introduce something called a vaccine. Let me just explain why. The younger people my age, I'm 62, so a youngish fit person or younger, almost none of them died of this so-called virus. So why would you want to vaccinate all the population when most people have got perfectly satisfactory immunity? So that was one thing, and yet Bill Gates and others wanted a needle in every arm, and they still want a needle in every arm. But I've got something even more fatal to the narrative. Most people will know that you're offered, usually free, an annual flu vaccine. Well, the thing is, I had a look at the meta-analysis over a decade in the UK, and it turns out that flu vaccines do not reduce severe flu or death from flu in the UK. And I can tell you why they don't work. The reason that elderly, frail people are vulnerable is their immune system slowed down and doesn't respond well to new challenges, right? That sounds uncontroversial. Why in the world, Alex, would you think they'd respond well to vaccines? And they don't. So the people who get benefit don't need it, and the people who are at risk of death don't get the benefit. The whole thing is a lie. Don't go near these so-called vaccines, which I will talk about in depth.
We've got a few minutes to break and we'll come back, but you've really called it years ago it was happening, but you've now said, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but your own words, that this is a premeditated, poisonous or dangerous thing. Speak to how you know it's premeditated, and then why would they do it? Why would they think they're going to get away with it? Because now it looks like they're not getting away with it thanks to you.
Well, I'm not the only one. I think the main weapon they have against people like me, and you will know all about this, is censorship. I'm probably one of the most censored people. I've been ejected off Twitter, and I've not been allowed back despite my appeals. I can't comment under a YouTube video or post any. They get deleted in real time as I type them. I can't, you know, if you Google me, you'll find I'm a conspiracy theorist. But if you use something like Yandex, which is a Russian browser, you will find 80 interviews by me. So, you know, so basically they're not frightened of people like me because they figure that I won't be heard. So here's the thing. Please, listener, what I ask you to do is memorize two or three of the most powerful things I told you. You must go and tell 10 other people. Please don't tell me it's hard. I know it's hard. I've been trying to do this for almost 3 years. But the only way we'll win is if you tell 10 other people. The mass media is never going to tell them, right? They're never going to tell them. And they won't work it out on their own. They're still in the narrative.
Well, that's right. Stay there. That's so powerful, though. The people have to mobilize. They tell 10. They tell 10. Tell them tell 10. Chain reaction. Stay there, Dr. Michael Yeadon. We'll come right back.
Just come into The Secret Truth, and you'll be able to listen to that whole interview. Next, we have Steve Bannon interviewing James O'Keefe. And O'Keefe is head of Project Veritas. And they're talking about this undercover recording of a Pfizer research director, actually head of research for Pfizer. And he talks about evolutionary changes that are being incurred by Pfizer to create a greater business model. This is just diabolical stuff that were directive evolution is what they're calling that. But listen to this fine interview that Steve Bannon has.
James O'Keefe joins us from Project Veritas. James, every time you're coming on now, I say, man, how did he get that? It's a blockbuster with his Facebook, the CRT at the school, the gender-affirming surgery. But this one may be the most important I think you've ever done because this is the reason it's gone viral with I don't know how many million hits. Walk us through what we heard, how important this is, particularly today. I know you dropped it on the eve of the FDA meeting today about the bivalent booster. Walk us through what we just saw and how important that is, sir.
Thank you, Steve. Well, this is an undercover investigation The most watched video in Project Veritas history, Steve. It's got, I think, 14 million views on Twitter right now. And this is an executive. He does mRNA scientific planning. He's one of Pfizer's directors of research and development. We have an internal staff chart confirming he is who he says he is. He does indeed work for Pfizer. And he's basically talking about lying to the public, deceiving the public about what they do there at Pfizer. And most of our stories at Project Veritas involve powerful people lying to the American people. Perhaps one of the greatest, one of the worst things that he says is that it's bad for Americans what they're doing, but good for Pfizer. And he said, and he begs us not to tell anybody that they're discussing mutating the virus. They're taking steps towards doing that. And he says that the virus, he suspects, started in Wuhan. Nothing that would shock you or your audience, but it's interesting to hear it come out of the mouths of pharmaceutical executives, Steve.
James, one of the things that people's heads are blowing up globally when you talk about the 14 million, and by the way, Veritas has been around for, what, 12 years or longer. So to say that it's the most watched in your history is saying something. One of the things I know from talking to people around the globe at when this thing came out is he talks about mutating. There's one thing to kind of look at that or do it, because they're talking about right now in the FDA having a different booster every year on mutations. But it sounds like he's talking about gain-of-function research conducted by Pfizer. Is that what you surmise also?
Well, we had a Twitter Spaces. We had a number of doctors on there, including Dr. Malone and some other doctors, and they said that he's playing a language game. So we asked, our journalist asked, isn't that gain-of-function? And he kind of demurred, but he called it something else. And he changed the language of what he was referring to. It doesn't actually change what it is that he's doing. He called it, quote, directed evolution, which sounds maybe even more sinister. But similar to the CRT, critical race theory educator we caught last week, he also tried to change the language of it. He said, well, I don't call it critical race theory, I could still do it. Likewise, the Pfizer executive is effectively saying, well, if you don't call it gain of function, you know, what we're doing, he said, don't tell anybody. He repeatedly said this, please don't tell anybody, please don't share this with people. He was very emphatic about that when he talked about the animal experiments that Pfizer does. He says, quote, this is a direct quote, promise you won't tell anyone. The way the experiment will work is that we put the virus in monkeys and we successively cause them to keep infecting each other and we collect serial samples from the monkeys. You have to be very controlled to make sure this virus, when you mutate it, it doesn't go everywhere. So you may be asking, what is Pfizer's response to this? They have responded in a way. They've shut down the comments on their social media accounts like TikTok. And I've learned that Pfizer has started interrogating inside their company today, just as in the last couple of hours. They sort of have interrogated everyone to figure out who is the source of the leaks to Project Veritas, Steve, last night. A number of brand new Pfizer whistleblowers have come to us after we published the video.
James, correct me if I'm wrong. They started to sweep all his social media accounts. People came to me and said they're making this guy a non-person right now. Is there any truth to that, sir?
Well, they may try to make him a non-person, but he actually is a person. We cached some of the screenshots. I published that on my Twitter page. And we have his he went to Yale. He graduated Yale 2013, got his Doctor of Medicine at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School. He's based in New York. He's worked as a consultant to something called the Boston Consulting Group, a urology resident at Massachusetts General Hospital. We have his Pfizer email address, his boss. Her name is Shuang Wu, who is three under the CEO of the company. Steve, this is not a low-level person. Which is something they haven't said because it's not a low-level person. And I think Pfizer's response verifies the story even more. They haven't said it's fake. We know that this guy works for Pfizer. We stand by reporting. And as I speak, Steve, we just posted my interaction with him, with Jordan Walker, in New York City the other night. I walked up to him with a microphone like I do, and he physically assaulted my cameraman. That video is online as of 5 minutes ago.
We're going to pull that here momentarily. By the way, Boston Consulting Group is one of the most prestigious in the world. Where is your investigation on this going? I know you can't give the details of all your undercover work, but directionally, where are you heading on your assault, frontal assault on Big Pharma, sir?
Yeah, assault, pun intended. Actually, the NYPD asked me if I wanted, we wanted to press charges again. This is extraordinary. This is like a soap opera slash, you know, Pfizer Watergate. It's just, it's riveting. It's tragic. It's enlightening. I think the future for us is finding brave people on the inside of Pfizer to go on the record. And that would be what I would say is the future of this, because we would not have been able to fully verify this report, but not for people on the inside of Pfizer. In fact, the person who recorded this is a Pfizer person. So there's a lot of people inside the company that are shocked, outraged, indignant, and have a conscience. And I would say if you're watching this program, which many of you I'm certain are, you can look behind my head. I always do this, Steve, on your program. You go to that website right there, projectveritas.com/brave. We're going to see, Steve, the reaction to this latest report we just put out. The guy physically assaulted us, and then we'll publish our next report after that.
James, how do people go to support your work? It's incredible, and I know you have a ton of small donors, and the Warren Posse is honored to be part of that. Where do they go to support this work?
Yes, and I love the segment that you put in there, brought to you by Pfizer, brought to you by Pfizer. We are not brought to you by Pfizer. We're not brought to you by anybody. It is really – isn't it interesting? We grow up and we watch TV and we just accept these programs are literally paid for by powerful entities. So Veritas is a nonprofit organization. We're tax deductible. We're a charity like Cars for Kids or Habitat for Humanity. You get a tax deduction when you donate to us. And we don't take advertising money. I don't necessarily criticize everybody who does, as long as there's a firewall, but we don't have advertisers and no one tells me what not to do. We operate truly without fear and without favor towards anyone. So I would donate on the website.
I want everybody in the Warren Posse to go there today and find out more about Veritas. And I can verify you do not tell James O'Keefe what to do. He's a man on a mission. James, honored to have you on here. We're going to play the rest of the tapes and tomorrow. It's just incredible. This is a blockbuster.
Just went live. Play the interaction with the guy for your audience. It's unbelievable.
We will, sir. James O'Keefe, thank you very much. Honored to have you on here.
You need to go into the and see the different videos concerning this particular outing of this Pfizer official. Because he's confronted by James O'Keefe in a restaurant, and he just goes berserk. I mean, this thing is really just blowing up on everybody, and it's ironic, you know, that they would be bragging, you know, in the open like this, so braggadocious, you know what I mean? That this is just really opening themselves up for final, you know, problems, you know what I mean? And anyway, so coming up next, we've got Joe Rogan eviscerates CNN, and he says this is not their job. So listen carefully what he has to say.
Let's talk about what happened over the weekend. You would think that CNN would know how to cover a story that happened in their own neighborhood. After all, their headquarters is in Atlanta. But Antifa decided that it would be a great idea to start making it impossible for the cops to open up a new academy, which, was financed by their union. Didn't everyone want more training to reimagine police? So they're upgrading training. They're upgrading equipment in Atlanta. By the way, this is what the governor's going to be speaking about in his State of the State address, as Brian Kemp possibly keeps his eyes on national office, bigger than the one in Georgia. But as this violence ensues, we were astounded here at our various locations that people were not pointing out that Antifa, full of privileged white kids, were having these coordinated attacks with flashbangs, some with firearms, massive arrests, that people weren't calling it as they see it, pretending as if this wasn't bad as any unrest that we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years. And we were not the only ones. Listen to this outrageous guest on CNN, which is still technically a news network.
I think that there's a real blurring of the lines in the use of the word violence. You keep using these words, violent, 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 And it gives the impression, I mean, the only violence or the only acts of violence against people that I saw were actually police tackling protesters.
Okay, so you see in some of the, there was property damage. And a police car was set on fire and windows smashed. Six protesters were charged in all, including for domestic terrorism. Two of them are out on bond, four denied bond, a number of them not from Atlanta. But, and look right there. Okay, so that is not violent. You know who says that? One of the senior advisors to Stacey Abrams, Marissa Pyle, senior rapid response manager at the Stacey Abrams Fair Fight Action, said this regarding the comments. You cannot commit violence. This all comes down to what do you think violence is. She says you cannot commit violence against a window or a car. Killing a human, now that is violence. Shame on Atlanta's leaders who fall into the same tired path of protecting property while our people are being murdered by their police. So for her, the line is murder. You kill somebody, then you're in trouble. But just, you know, blowing up a police car, that's not violence.
Yeah, Joe Rogan took issue with this, mm-hmm. slamming the media for gaslighting these riots and acting as a propaganda department. Listen.
You're willing to overlook some awful on your side, and you're willing to exaggerate some on the other side. But everybody's on the same team, so you have to pretend these people lighting churches on fire aren't. These people lighting schools on fire and lighting courthouses on fire. The mostly peaceful. Oh, it's mostly peaceful that
burning
occurring.
In the background.
I saw someone again say this of what happened in Atlanta.
Yeah, the Cop City thing.
Yeah, and they were
there
calling
was literally
this thing,
a cop car on fire.
Anyway, they're calling it mostly peaceful
in CNN's backyard.
You
I know it's
can't
fantastic.
You're not the propaganda department. You can't define things in a way to calm people down. That's not what your job is.
But that's right.
But you're bull people. You're acting as a propagandist. Like that's not it's not mostly peaceful when a car's on fire.
So not only are you not ignoring right. it, you're misdescribing it. And the other thing to add is most experts say the coordination shows this thing was rehearsed. So much to which they did, the way they acted, the way they communicated, shows an organization, not an idea. Antifa is as despicable as the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, but nobody wants to point that out. The FBI director comes out and goes, Antifa's more of an idea. No, they got stocking caps, coordination. They probably have monthly meetings and dues. Most of them, as you take their masks off, find out they're from privileged backgrounds, and their family must really be proud.
The governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, put out a statement. He said his office will not tolerate unlawful crimes in the name of peaceful protest.
Yeah, and Joe Rogan also went on to talk about how they just are shoving ideas down people's throats. And he said that's what tribal instinct is. And he said that's what he believes religion has always done. But he said if you flip it and you talk to an atheist, they believe so strongly they're trying to shove it down your throat. So in a sense, it is their religion. They just don't have a deity. So I thought that was fascinating.
Absolutely.
You know?
And one thing I will say about the Joe Rogan podcast, I don't generally listen to it. Whoever does the beeping on his show, actually, they don't beep. We do for our show. Their finger must be worn out.
Okay, no, when Joe Rogan first came on the scene and everyone's talking about how good his podcasts are, I'm driving out to Long Island. My daughter's in her car seat in the back, and I started listening, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, trying to find the controls.
Right.
I didn't realize that it's not a family-friendly.
Yeah, right. Growing up on the LIE with Mom. I can't wait to see her children's book. I found out early it was okay to use the F word when I really mean something.
She was too young to even know what it was, but I quickly changed the channel.
Good idea.
This recent beating and then the subsequent death a few days later of this individual in Memphis, Tennessee is setting off a firestorm. And there were five black officers involved in that beating that stopped. And that beating, and then subsequently, he died in the hospital a few days later. So, there is a firestorm occurring in different cities throughout the country. And I can't say, I can't blame them in a way. I mean, the way this thing went down in the video was very bad. So anyway, let's hope and pray and try to bring some quietness to this madness out here. but and try to curtail any violence as soon as possible to get over this. But here we go with the people discussing the madness out there, what went on.
All right, here with more is the host of the co-host of The Five, Geraldo Rivera, and the host of Lawrence Jones Cross Country. LJ is with us, and Fox News contributor and former D.C. homicide detective Ted Williams. Thank you all for being with us. LJ, let me start with you. You watch this tape. You see this tape. Mm-hmm. And I know so many people in law enforcement, and I was looking for this five guys there against one young man. Mm-hmm. And obviously they have the advantage. They're pulling out their stun guns. They're pulling out pepper spray. They're mad. They're angry. At no time did I hear anyone say, sir, everybody calm down. We're not going to hurt you. We're not here to hurt you. But we do have to take you into custody. We really need your cooperation. Tone could mean everything. I heard nothing but anger, like real anger. And you see the physicality here. We're talking about 5-on-1. That part, I'm having a hard time. That is not the policing that I believe officers are trained in.
You know, Sean, we've done this a lot. We review the facts, the evidence, and we don't rush the judgment. But you can't deny what you see on tape. And I'm not just talking for myself. I'm talking about the officers that I've been texting back and forth. Sean, when you brought me to the channel, I've been covering crime for a long time. So I know a lot of cops. Talked to them on a day-to-day basis. And they're all horrified. They want to wish their condolences to the Nichols family. But, Sean, there were several things in this video that just stood out to me. You come to the scene out of control. Out of control. You disobey police policy. You don't just roll up on a car like that. You don't know what the suspect could possibly have. You put yourself at risk, and then you slaughtered the suspect. You started to spray each other with the spray because you're not using it the right way. You use your taser the wrong way. You use your batons the wrong way. You didn't restrain the suspect the right way. I mean, that's just basic police protocol. And then I just can't get past the fact that you held the suspect up and you beat him. You took turns. You use your baton in the wrong way. And then I just can't help but be annoyed by the fact that they fist bumped at the end. So there was many layers to this. Basic police protocol was broken right here. They were on a power trip, and he didn't have to die that night. He was crying out for his mom. Again, they have the right to defend themselves in the court of law. But just from a tactic standpoint, basic police protocol. Sean, I started off when I was 16 years old as a police explorer. I know protocol, and they broke every rule in the book.
You know, Geraldo, LJ's right. He's crying for his mom at one point. He's literally getting punched and kicked and pepper sprayed, and tasered. And, you know, there's five cops there. They're supposed to be the trained professionals in a situation. Look, he was obviously scared, obviously felt they were being overly aggressive from the get-go and said so. Hey, guys, there's a lot going on here early on. There was nobody there that tried to even defuse it. And then, you know, to watch this one cop just come walking in disgusted and just kick this kid in the head, not once, but twice. You know, a kick in the head kills people, Geraldo. Mm-hmm.
You know, Sean, this wasn't five cops. This was a wolf pack. This was a cowardly, sadistic bunch of brutes who murdered a man right before our very eyes. That's the most eerie thing about it. You're watching a dead man screaming for his mother. I mean, it is outrageous. It is the most pathetic thing I've ever seen. And where the hell was a police sergeant? Where was a supervisor? You have these five macho cops out there who I don't know how much training they had. They're instinct was to lash out, was to inflict pain, was to torture this young man to death. It is really, it makes me want to puke. It is the most sickening thing I've ever seen in terms of police brutality. And the way that the one cop kind of winds up
and then goes 10, 15 mm-hmm. feet to land a blow, a kick to the victim's head, and then another kick, and then the other one takes a turn. And he's obviously defenseless. I mean, it is, you know, it is really, I when I first heard the charges of murder too, I said, wow, that's pretty serious this early in the game. But when you see this, it is clear that this was reckless disregard for human life. This is murder too at least, Sean.
Ted Williams, I like Geraldo, like LJ, I know a lot of police officers, and I'm watching, and I see five cops around him, and I find it almost spectacularly unbelievable to me that five trained officers, obviously lacking in a lot of training, that they can't cuff one young man and they can't get control of the situation, and they all let their, seemingly all of them, most of them anyway, let their tempers get the better of them. They took it so personally. No, there was no attempt to defuse the situation in any way, which I believe easily could have been done. There was even simple jujitsu 101 maneuvers could have, you know, enabled the police to easily cuff this guy. But none of them seem to have any of that training at all. The only training that they seem to be, they only seem to be trained to be angry. And I'm not sure where the anger came from. There are always going to be people during an arrest that don't want to be arrested. That is part of the job. But them doing it professionally has to happen. That didn't happen here. Why?
Well, you asked an excellent question. You have to first go back and ask, where was the humanity of these police officers? The first thing we see in the first video, they are coming up aggressively to this man's car, and they don't talk to the man. They rip him out of his automobile, and they immediately start pepper spraying him. And then, Sean, if you go to the video 4 that was on the lamppost, you see how inhumane these officers are. They're kicking this man in the head. They're beating him. They're saying, show me your hands or give me your hands. While they're still, the man is in pain. And he's calling for his mother. And he says initially, when they took him out of that car, Sean, he said, why? I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't do anything wrong. Or, Sean, this is just terribly outrageous. But, Sean, let me make sure we are clear here. Black men and women who are dead and children are crying from the grave. We didn't do anything. This is an excellent example, unfortunately, what has happened to black people throughout the history of this country. And I'm very, very upset about these four or five black officers. Black officers treating another black man the way they treated this man. This was, you don't even treat a dog this way. This was just inhumane, and I think Geraldo is right. Where in the hell was the supervisor? Why wasn't the supervisor there on the scene supervising this situation? You have to ask yourself, how do you drag a man?
There wasn't one of these five officers, Ted. But, Ted, there wasn't one of these officers that didn't have enough sense training to stand back, objectively realize everyone's getting out of control, call for calm, let their professionalism take over, talk to the suspect, talk him down, talk calmly, say it's going to be all right. Nobody wants to get hurt here. We want to make sure that we take care of you as well. We have our job to do. Help us do our job. Tone, cadence, that matters in a moment like that.
You're absolutely right, Sean.
They got to the crime scene.
LJ, go ahead.
When they got there, Sean, and can I just say this? Because I think it's important to say this. Cops are the only profession that are judged by the individuals, the very few that do the wrong thing. They didn't just steal someone's life. They set the profession back.
Prepare for months of rage. Prepare for cops to be demonized over the actions of these people. They took this man's life. The other cops, the 95% that go out there and put a badge on every single day, you got to remember, Sean, we're already dealing with limited people in the profession. Way to go. Way to set us back. Because and now we're going to have to deal with some people stepping back as a result of this.
And Lawrence, this is what's going on. In the profession right now, we've got a lot of experienced police officers who are leaving the profession, and they're leaving it, and you've got these inexperienced cops out there that are doing the job. This is what's also going on in the profession. And yes, you're right, Lawrence. This sets the profession back. There are good men and women who put that uniform on every day and go out here and serve and protect the communities. These officers do not deserve to wear the uniform of Memphis, Tennessee as police officers.
Not a chance.
Geraldo, in this particular case, the suspect was African-American. The five cops involved were African-Americans. There's a so-called news network. It's a comedy channel, I guess. You have Van Jones saying that the police that killed Tyree Nichols were black, but they might still have been driven by racism. He says black people are not immune to anti-black messages. One of the sad facts about anti-black racism is that black people ourselves are not immune to its pernicious effects. And society's message that black people are inferior, unworthy, and dangerous is pervasive. And it's not just Van Jones. It's the Communication Workers of America. It's NPR. It's Al Sharpton. It's, you know, the attorney Ben Crump, who our colleague Jono talked to earlier tonight. Where does that come from here?
You know, Sean, Memphis, Tennessee is where, tragically, in April 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Since then, the city has been roiled by racial tension. It is now a predominantly black city with soaring crime. The police force is consistently undermanned. They are desperate for officers. They are searching for recruits everywhere. I don't know whether they've relaxed their standards or what the result is. All I know is what my eyes tell me after a half century in this business dealing with law and order and cops of all colors. What I see here men who are they reduce themselves to savage. I used the term wolf pack earlier. It was so uncontrolled. It was so undisciplined. It was so slanderously unprofessional. And Lawrence is right. And Ted's anguish is poignant. And Lawrence is right about setting back the shortage that we have now with cops after George Floyd and all these other incidents that have happened is so chronic. What the result of this will be is that neighborhood will be more resentful of the cops. There will be more crime. There will be harder for them to recruit officers. This is a body blow to law and order, to race relations. This is really awful. But if the protesters use this
more pain. When you say it's a body blow, Geraldo, when you say it's a body blow to racism, where's the racial component here? Now, there are good cops and there are bad cops. And to me, it has nothing to do with race. There are professional cops, as Ted said, as LJ said, as you said, that get up, put on that uniform. They know they're risking their lives, but they go to work every day to serve their communities and protect their communities. That transcends race to me. And in this case, there are just so many people trying to make this racial. Is this case racial? Because I don't see it.
The point is, Sean, I agree that what this does is strip race from the question of police training and police brutality. But you cannot avoid the reality that these were five black men, young black men, macho, esprit de corps, filled with verve and grit.
That's not what I asked you,
though. And they joined the
though.
Police force.
Is this racial?
And now look what they have done.
But
look, but my point is this. Look what they have done now. Look what they have done. The blow that
right,
they
let
have,
me go to LJ.
Have struck to the community.
Let me ask you the same question.
Your thoughts on the racial component.
This is a humanity
me,
issue.
It's about, sorry, I'm sorry, LJ, go ahead.
It's a humanity issue, Sean. I see where you're going with it. This is not having value for human life. This didn't have to go this way.
Right.
Whether he resisted or not, they didn't value his life. And apparently they didn't value their own life the way that they showed up to the scene. You don't go up to a car that way. That's basic police 101. And look, I agree with my colleague Ted. Training is an issue within some of the police departments right now, especially when it comes to the numbers that we have right now. But let's not be confused here. These gentlemen were a part of an elite unit, the Scorpions. Okay? That is equivalent to New York City's anti-crime unit. It takes grit to be on there. Okay, I understand the job that they have to do, which is why they should have had the proper training to conduct that stop. And they didn't do it the right way. It was selfish on multiple levels to the cops that serve that do the job the right way. But it's also, if we want to, since people want to put race in this, Sean, every black man knows about the talk that our father gives us, what you're supposed to do when you're stopped by a police officer. We have gentlemen that got the talk as well as our black police officers. So they just didn't value life. They didn't care about any of that in that moment.
All right. LJ, thank you. Ted Williams, thank you. Geraldo, thank you.
Anyway, coming up next is Rand Paul, and he's going to discuss this debt limit and so forth and what the Senate is going to try to do. In trying to resolve this increase in the lending and the debt limit and try and negotiate with the Democrats with some provisions that would try to ease this escalating debt. But here we go with Rand Paul.
Pleasure. Joining me is Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky. You know, Senator Paul, I want to get to you've got a plan on the debt ceiling, which I kind of like. But I mean, it's amazing to me, this big lie tactic. They keep accusing McCarthy, Republicans in general, of Medicare, Social Security, interest on the debt, all this stuff, all the scare tactics. It's the big lie. Communists used to use this all the time, probably still do. I mean, why is it? Why can't they be honest and truthful even for a nanosecond, Senator Paul?
Well, they're completely dishonest and worry the markets and are bad for the country and bad for all of us by saying, oh, we might default. There's absolutely no reason for us to default. Our interest payments are about $400 billion. We bring in about $5 trillion. So we have plenty of money to pay our interest payments. We have plenty of money to pay our soldiers, to pay our Social Security, and to pay for Medicare. Now, we don't have a lot of extra money beyond that. We're about a third overdrawn. So there's an enormous amount of government that we'd have to trim. Now, if you do it over about a five-year period, what I proposed recently is you bring the baseline down, you cut $100 billion immediately, and then you freeze spending for about 4 or 5 years. And guess what? You actually achieve balance through growth. And so it can be done, and it can be done with very small amounts, maybe not even cuts beyond the $100 billion, but by freezing spending.
So, Senator Paul, let's go through this. Very interesting. You were with Mike Braun, Ted Cruz, Ron Johnson, Mike Lee, Rick Scott, if I have that right. This is from your gang, your team. You want to take $100 billion out. Now, this is for the full budget, I assume, which is almost $6 trillion, $5.7 trillion. 1.7% cut of total outlays in FY24, which is coming up, what you all will face, and then freeze spending at that level for the next 3 years, freezing that spending. So how does that work out? How does that affect entitlements? How does that affect discretionary, et cetera, et cetera?
I'm confident that if you did the cut across the board to everything, a 1.7% cut, you would not know it happened. And I'll give you an example of how people who are very wedded in a project say, oh, you can't cut my project. Let's say Alzheimer's research, and there's $100 billion spent on Alzheimer's research. What would it be next year under this plan? It'd be like 98.5% or 98.3%. So it still would be a large amount of money. And it's the same with even things like Medicare. If you look at the overall budget of Medicare, what would happen if you froze the overall budget? Well, I think there's enough administrative costs and government waste within the system of a $1.3 trillion system that you could eliminate waste and actually do it without changing anybody's receiving their Medicare benefit. I do think, though, that things like Medicare and Social Security, if you want them to function long-term and you want to balance budgets and have surpluses, that you are going to need means testing, meaning that people like myself, like yourself, who have done well in life, really are going to have to pay the full cost of their Medicare and not have the working class subsidize your health care.
How about setting up a bipartisan commission to do that? That's a political issue. It's a policy issue. You know, I was around when Ronald Reagan was president in the first term. I was working in his OMB budget office. That's how he did it. He brought in Alan Greenspan. He brought in Pat Moynihan. He brought in the heads of the labor unions. I believe it was Lane Kirkland from the AFL-CIO. I could be wrong, but I think that was right. And they sat down and they came up with some reform plans. And it was bipartisan, and it passed. And by the way, it worked for the next 50 years. How about some kind of commission?
I've been recommending something similar for quite a while now, unfortunately without success. But I would use the model of the Joint Economic Committee. The Joint Economic Committee is evenly divided. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter whether Republicans are in charge or Democrats. There's equal number of Republicans and Democrats on it. They typically don't vote out legislation, but they discuss ideas. So it would be a standing committee. You would bring in the actuaries that measure Social Security soundness, Medicare soundness. You would talk about different proposals and what the outcome of. Many of these things are economic projections based on what you do. And in a reasonable, rational fashion, we would say, how do we preserve these programs that the bulk of Americans have come to assume and accept, but make them actually, you know, responsible, fiscally responsible? And the interesting thing about this, and most Americans don't know this, over half of the European governments run surpluses. Germany and Sweden both have big governments, both have big safety nets, but they run surpluses. So it can be done. It is a problem, though, to have chronic deficits because I think it's eroding us from within, and we ultimately could destroy the currency and this great country if we continue to let this debt grow apace.
Well, you know, my basic view here, I guess much, much like yours, is that the rise of government at all levels, but we focus on the federal government, 24% of GDP right now. That's a huge number. But you add on state and local, you're almost half. You're 44%. But that the rise of government, Senator Paul, is the single biggest obstacle to returning to growth. It is the biggest prosperity killer we have. And if you went back to 3.5% growth for the next 10 years, then that budget story brightens quite a lot.
Yeah, I seem to remember this guy. He was a president back in the 80s who said government is the problem, not the solution.
Yes, sir.
And he was absolutely right. But there's an enormous story here that is forgotten, often even by Republicans, doomsayers on the Republican side, is that we have an enormous engine that creates amazing wealth. The story of capitalism is told by, Marion Tupi and these other people who have talked about the superabundance and what has happened through trade and capitalism over the last 200 years. 200 years ago, almost everybody lived in abject poverty. The story of economic wealth is all along the zero, the x-axis, and to the last 200 years, and then it's been exponential growth. But we need to realize and teach our kids and discuss that this great wealth came from what Adam Smith talked about. We need to free up the economy. We need to understand that actually when we've reduced tax rates, we've gotten more revenue. We're still debating that, and yet the facts are in. They were in the 80s, and they're also in with the most recent tax cut, that cutting rates actually brought in more revenue and allowed more economic growth.
Absolutely, sir. You know, we just had Art Laffer on earlier this week debating this. Well, you didn't debate, but a White House spokesperson came up and tried to argue that the Trump corporate tax cut produced huge deficits. It's the reverse. It paid for itself and then some. Senator Paul, let me just add one thing before we lose you. I always appreciate your time. I'd like to restore workfare and work requirements to all of the benefit programs outside of the big entitlements, Social Security and Medicare. But the rest of it, going down the line, all the welfare programs, food stamps, housing subsidies, Medicaid, all of them, I would like to restore workfare. And my point here is not only will you get, first of all, people will come off the dole. Second of all, if they're working, they'll throw off income, which is taxable even at lower tax rates. And that work is a virtue anyway. That it will, you know, promote the American idea. It'll be a kind of remoralization instead of a demoralization. What do you think about that? That we did this 25 years ago. Why don't we do it again?
Without question, and we're working on it as we speak, when we did it in the 1990s, and it was heralded and lauded, and I applaud what was done, only about 4 out of 96 programs got work requirements. I want to see it added even more thoroughly throughout the system, and work should be seen by all as a benefit, as a plus, as an asset, not as punishment. It's a cultural thing as far as a society thing. You need people to work. And one of the terrible disasters, people died from COVID, but also the work ethic is dying and being killed by government disincentives. So we've got to reverse that trend.
Thank you, Senator Paul. Siri, just on that point alone, thank you ever so much.
Well, this country's got a lot of problems. And we pray for that family of that man that was, beaten and finally died out in Memphis. We hope and pray that this will not set off tremendous riots like we've seen before. But there is a reason to protest here. That's for sure. But come on in to thesecrettruth.com, and you can pick up. I'll have embedded Dr. Yearden, the interview that Alex had with Dr. Yearden, former official of Pfizer. And so, and then, I might put some other embedded, full interviews up also. But, come in and take a look at it and go back and look at some of our past interviews. But anyway, I want to thank, everyone out there for being, patient with each other. And that's what we have to do. We have to forgive and forget, and we've got to be patient. We've got to try to bring this country together. And this war is very ongoing, and the danger of a nuclear conflict is ever present. And we just must not reach that point. We must stop short of that, because a nuclear response from both sides would be disastrous for this world. So anyway, we've got to hope and pray that that will not happen, and hope and pray that no accident or something like that could set off an exchange of nuclear weapons, because this is not what we need, anybody needs. Let's hope and pray for Ukrainians to settle with the Russians to settle with the Ukrainians, to try to minimize any future conflict and death in that war right now. But anyway, I hope and pray for each and every one of you, and I bless all your souls. And let's just try to continue to do the right thing out here and love one another and be good neighbors. Good night. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.